Okay, we're going to get started. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Ben Swinburne, Morgan Stanley's media analyst. Please note that important disclosures, including my personal holdings disclosures and Morgan Stanley disclosures, all appear as a handout available in the registration area and on the Morgan Stanley public website. And we're thrilled to welcome to the conference for the first time to my left, Bob Iger, the Chairman and CEO of Walt Disney. Mr. Iger served as President and CEO beginning in October of 2005, and during his tenure has transformed the company with the acquisitions of Pixar, Marvel, and Lucasfilm, as well as the opening of Shanghai Disney. Bob, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Ben.
Before we get into the Q&A, I want to at least acknowledge the obvious and congratulate you and the Marvel team on the success of Black Panther, which continues to exceed our expectations anyway.
Yes, it exceeds our expectations too. Although, we thought we had a really strong movie on our hands, and we really believed in the character and the story. Otherwise, we wouldn't have given the director the money to make the movie that he made. But I must say, he set out to make a great movie, and when you make a great movie, it also becomes an important moment in a culture. It's pretty exhilarating.
Yeah.
This one really is. Incredible numbers.
Absolutely. So let's start off at a high level. I want to talk about a couple of things. But 2017 was a big year for the company. You made a number of big strategic announcements and strategic steps around over-the-top initiatives. And of course, you've announced a planned acquisition of most of 21st Century Fox. So as you look at 2018, what are the key priorities for you and the company this year?
You touched upon them, really. First of all, we obviously want to get through the regulatory process as smoothly as possible and then integrate the 21st Century Fox assets. We've spent a lot of time since the deal was announced thinking hard about how best to structure the company in a post-acquisition mode, and we'll be ready, even when the acquisition is approved, we believe it will be, of course, to hit the ground running with an organization that's designed to operate in the most modern fashion, particularly in a business or in a world that is as dynamic as it is. So that would be priority one. Second priority is, you mentioned it, we announced we were going into the OTT business. At that point, it was Disney and ESPN. And obviously, when the acquisition's approved, we'll also have a controlling stake in Hulu. That becomes an even larger part of our OTT initiatives. And so from a priority perspective, that's right at the top as well. And then, of course, continuing to do what we've done best as a company, which is to create great product and execute well across the world by basically leveraging that product across all of our businesses and in all the territories that we do business.
Sure. Let's talk a little more about the Fox transaction. One of the things I was talking to the group about earlier when we were talking about your stock is, when and if you close this transaction, you will have a substantial portfolio of OTT and retail distribution assets with Sky and Hulu, Hotstar, plus the ones at Disney, ESPN, and Disney over-the-top. And these are businesses that you have not historically run at Disney, at least at scale. So why should investors look at this portfolio as a positive for Disney? And what are you doing to make sure that management has the bandwidth and also the expertise to execute on all this in front of you?
Well, I think, if you don't mind, we'll take a step back and look at what the core strategies of the company have been and how consistent this acquisition is with those core strategies. We've been a company that is emphasized, and it's evident in how we have invested our capital, the value of high-quality branded entertainment. And the acquisitions of Pixar, Marvel, and Lucasfilm, Star Wars, obviously were a reflection of that core strategy. This gives us a larger portfolio of high-quality branded content. You think about FX, and you think about National Geographic, and you think about a number of the franchises that Fox has created, including their Marvel franchises and Avatar and other product. We believe that this fits beautifully into a strategy to continue to invest in entertainment, particularly in a world that seems to be growing in terms of its appetite to consume entertainment. Secondly, we've we've been talking a lot about using technology to reach consumers in more modern, more efficient and effective ways, but that's certainly changed significantly. When I talk about a dynamic marketplace, I think it's most evident in how people access entertainment, how they consume entertainment. This acquisition gives us the ability not only to have essentially more product, more intellectual property, but to bring it to the consumer in more compelling ways, in ways we think the consumer wants their entertainment more and more. The Star and Sky assets and the Hulu assets give us an opportunity to do that. And then lastly, we've talked a lot about wanting to grow our company globally. The Walt Disney Company has been a global company for a long time, but in many of the markets that we operated, our penetration was relatively superficial. We spent a fair amount of time over the last decade deepening that penetration in markets. You mentioned Shanghai Disneyland, which would be an example of how we've done that in China. This gives us the ability to have a far more global footprint and to diversify the company's interest from a geographic perspective. In terms of what you talked about earlier and us not having the expertise on the direct-to-consumer side, well, one of the, I think, nice things about this acquisition, it doesn't only come with businesses, it comes with the people that operate those businesses and the experience that they have to operate these businesses quite effectively. If you look at what they've done, as for instance in India, which is quite impressive to us, they have expertise that our company will take full advantage of. And our intention, what I talked about earlier, which is creating a structure of the company that is aimed at basically being more modern and aimed at integrating these assets in a far more effective way. One of the things we want to do is we want to look across our company and share best practices. Many of, particularly as it relates to distribution, many of those best practices will come from the people and the assets that we're acquiring here.
Great. So I think most people can see how IP from Fox and distribution expertise help Disney strategically. You also are acquiring a number of linear television networks, both in the entertainment and sports areas. Maybe you could talk about why those assets are interesting to Disney as well.
Well, for the most part, we've looked at channels less as channels and more as brands.
Right.
And it's less important to us how people get those channels. Obviously, it's important in terms of how they're monetized in today's world, but what's more important to us is the quality of the brand and the intellectual property that it fits under that brand umbrella. And our intention is to, as the world shifts in terms of distribution and consumption we talked about earlier, is to migrate those brands and those products in the more modern direction from a distribution and consumption perspective. So look, it's different in various places around the world. The disruptive nature of the media business is probably at its greatest in the United States in terms of change from the past to the present and the future. So there, I think the sense of, if you want to call it sense of urgency, or the interest that we have in bringing product out on an OTT basis is probably at the great at its highest.
Sure.
In Europe, there's been some disruption, but the MVP ecosystem there is a little more healthy. Actually, free TV in some markets is still somewhat healthy. And so the channels will certainly play a role in terms of how we monetize this content for the foreseeable future. But ultimately, again, we look at these as essentially collections of high-quality product versus just a channel.
Got it.
But, so I think that, you know, there's still, I think, a fair amount of runway in terms of how these are monetized in a more traditional, from a more traditional perspective. But what we've tried to do is design a company that is capable of thriving in a fully disrupted world, or a world that doesn't look anything like the media world that we currently live in.
And just to maybe wrap up on Fox, I mean, one of the things you're going to bring in-house is a lot more international diversification, particularly in the television networks. I think they do over $1 billion of EBITDA at Fox International. You mentioned Star. Do you see a lot of growth opportunity for those international channels at Fox that you're acquiring? And is your strategy different overseas than it is here?
There are consistencies to the strategy, but we're also looking at a strategy that has localism in mind, whether it's Europe or in Asia. There are markets that share a lot of similarities, but there's no two markets that are exactly the same is also evident to us. That we believe that there's huge growth potential in certain markets on the media front. Certainly, India would be one example of that. They launched a product called Hotstar, which is an OTT product that we are quite interested in, on top of their, in fact, their channel or more traditional business. In Europe, Sky as well has gone into the business of basically providing, well, they're an OTT product, a different kind of product. We think there are some interesting opportunities there, and there are interesting opportunities to take those products that exist in the markets they exist in today and spread them to other markets as well, not just operate in the markets that they're in. And of course, there are opportunities for us to use those platforms to distribute our product on more effectively too. And again, to learn more about the direct-to-consumer business in general, which our company will, we think, will benefit greatly from.
Sure. Okay, let's talk about that direct-to-consumer strategy and over-the-top. It's probably the question I get the most from investors. You're about to launch ESPN+, I think, in the next couple of months, and you've got the Disney-branded service coming out in 2019 on the over-the-top front. So how does Disney maximize the opportunity from OTT and at the same time, you know, balance and maximize the opportunity in the legacy businesses that, you know, generate most of their earnings from the traditional ecosystem?
It's no secret that we've seen the development and the growth of an entirely new media marketplace. And so we start with the premise that we want to participate in this new marketplace or this new market. Right now, we're only doing so at the sort of tip of the iceberg, so to speak, with Hulu would be an example of that. And we have a relatively small stake in Hulu, over 30%. So our OTT interests are essentially designed to be part of this new marketplace first. And I talked about it earlier. If you look at how the consumer today wants their media, first of all, they're far more interested in mobile, mobile first in many cases. Their user interface is particularly critical. This is really true for millennials and younger.
Yeah.
Where the user interface that exists in the sort of traditional television platform is not as compelling to them. It's essential for us to provide our content on platforms and with user interfaces that are serving today's consumer better. We also believe that we need to contend with disruption in the most effective possible way. And one way to do that is to participate in the very business that is doing the disrupting, which is, you know, very technologically driven media landscape today. And you can also add other factors, which is people being more interested in programming than channels, certainly in programs than channels. Certainly, that's the case in the United States. The ability to binge watch would be another example of that. Subscription, but a subscription that essentially, from a price-value relationship, feels like it's delivering a significant amount of value to the subscriber. Also, the flexibility of not having to subscribe for long periods of time, also viewed as, I think, quite positive. So what we've been developing pre-Fox, but obviously it will be enhanced once we acquire Fox or once we get regulatory approval, are businesses that basically fit the profile of today's consumer, serve the consumer with this great IP that this company has and will have more of in more modern ways. ESPN, might as well, I guess, focus on that first, and then we'll talk about Disney.
Sure.
What we're doing with ESPN is we're launching a brand new app for ESPN end of March or early April. It's essentially an app that will continue to provide users with scores and highlights, but it will do so in a much more compelling way. First of all, the quality of the video will be much higher. Secondly, we're adding substantial levels of personalization and customization. We're essentially improving, from a technological perspective, how we're going to serve the consumer with that app in a very, very significant way. In addition, it's going to have the stream primary channels of ESPN available through that app. It will be on an authenticated basis. So if you're a subscriber to a digital MVPD, an MVPD, you can watch ESPN on that same app. Thirdly, we're adding an augmented product or an ESPN Plus app that will have about 10,000 additional live sports events available in the first year, as well as a number of other programs. The 30 for 30 series, for instance, will be on that. And it's essentially designed for the most avid sports fan. Very user-friendly in terms of the interface, mobile first. It'll work great on smartphones and on tablets and on smart TVs. And it'll have a substantial amount of additional sports programming. Over time, our intention would be for that app to be the primary app that people essentially access ESPN on. But we're going to manage the migration of that very carefully, because right now we have a business, a multi-channel business, that is serving us quite well in terms of the revenue that it delivers from a subscription perspective, but also the consumers that it delivers so that we can sell advertising on it. What we see happening is continued growth of the digital MVPDs, which is a different product in that it is less expensive by a lot and offers fewer channels. But so far, we've managed to negotiate deals with the distributors for ESPN to be in all of the offerings. Mm-hmm. We've seen some very, very attractive growth in those platforms, and we think that is a sign of the times and a sign of what is to come, which is continued migration to basically smaller bundles, but with us as part of those bundles. And that's actually quite a positive development for us, because consumers will save a lot of money in the process, but they'll use the money that they're saving to buy up new services, whether they're ours like Hulu or a Disney product or others like Netflix. We like actually the signs that we're seeing.
Right.
And on a Disney front, we're going to launch sometime in later 19. That will have the output of our studios. So our studio slate, starting in calendar 19, which happens to be a good year for the studio because it has an Avengers movie, Toy Story 4, Lion King, Frozen, Aladdin, Dumbo, and I could probably name a number of others. So those will be available in the so-called pay window,
right,
on the Disney service only, not on other services, so exclusive to our platform. We'll also have a significant amount of studio library product. In addition to that, we'll have about 5,000 episodes of Disney-branded television, and we're also going to make original series for that service starting in 2019. We've talked about a Marvel series, a Star Wars series, a Disney-branded series, High School Musical, for instance, and we'll be making original movies for direct to, basically direct to OT, to not over the top, but DTC, direct to consumer, on that platform, launching that. And there, since I've been asked a lot about it, we are constantly asked about competing with Netflix. Netflix is a completely different business in the sense that they are a very high volume business. They have a lot of quality to offer as well. It's a good product. We're going to be in the business of less volume but more branded product. So Marvel, Star Wars, Pixar, Disney is part of that. Those brands are in enough demand and will have enough quality that we believe that it will enable us to take a product to market with less volume. So we'll have enough on it to serve consumers who are subscribing to that service and want enough programming, but we believe that the brand proposition that we offer enables us to essentially make or supply substantially less programming for our direct-to-consumer service.
You touched on a lot there, just going back to the ESPN app, since that's coming very shortly. How did you think about pricing this service, and is there a subscription element to it and also an a la carte sort of buy per game?
Initially, the reason we priced it at $4.99 is because the primary quality of ESPN will continue to be on their main channels in terms of the highest quality sports. Not to suggest that the sports that we're putting on it are low quality,
but most popular.
Right. Thank you very much.
No offense to the squash fans.
Exactly. Squash and cricket. I don't want to denigrate them. And because it's an augmented service, it's not a replacement for the primary service. We thought we would price it $4.99 to be reasonable. And again, it's, as I said, it's an augmented service. The app is free,
right,
and the streaming of the channels is free. I mean, there isn't an additional fee for that, but you have to be a subscriber to a multi-channel service. If in time we have the ability to buy up higher quality or more popular programming, then I imagine you'll see that price rise for the augmented service. We also believe we have an opportunity to offer much more flexible pricing down the road. We won't do it initially, where you'll be able to buy seasons, you'll be able to buy teams, you'll be able to buy weekends, for instance. We're also going to offer through that service the Major League Baseball and the National Hockey League at a market product, as they do today. But you'll be able to buy it off of the same app, not as part of the $4.99, but from the same app.
And this is all being powered by BAMTech?
Yes. So the acquisition of BAMTech gives us the technology to do all this. It gives us the technology not only to stream under high-quality circumstances and volume, but it also gives us the ability from a technological perspective to serve advertisers with dynamic ad insertion, which we haven't had before, and to gather the data that is necessary and to crunch the data that is necessary to offer the personalization and the customization that we actually think is something sports fans probably want more than anyone else. If you want to buy by the, if you want to be served by the type of sports that you're interested in, or by the team, or by the geographic region, then this technology will enable us to do that.
Right. And then on the Disney OTT side, I think you had talked previously about 4 to 5 original TV series and 4 to 5 new original movies. Is that still...
At launch.
At launch. The sort of initial parameters around how you're thinking about it.
Yeah, we'll have the output of the studio. We'll have 4 to 5 original series, 4 to 5 original movies, and then all the library product that I talked about earlier, movie and mm-hmm. television library product. And then, as we'll see how that goes, and we'll have a better sense of what kind of volume we can provide once the Fox acquisition is approved, then we'll have the ability to add more content to it. Mm-hmm. National Geographic comes to mind, as for instance. We'll be able to make more original content using some of their IP as well and their production capabilities.
Sure. And how are you thinking about the timing of the global? Is it a global launch for Disney OTT, or how are you thinking about international versus domestic?
The launch is primarily U.S., and then we'll launch selectively in international markets at the appropriate time. I'd imagine that the U.K. would probably be first because we've launched a direct-to-consumer service there already, but then we'll be selective based on opportunity and based on availability of IP, meaning the movie output deals, because we have deals in place already, not all of whom expire when the Netflix deal expires.
Sure. Okay, great. Let's shift a little bit into the existing businesses that you're running today at Disney. So on the media network side, you had the beginning of a renewal process late last year with Altice. I think everyone's interested in sort of how these negotiations and the process of renewing your television networks compares to prior cycles. And it would seem externally like these are tougher than ever. We're seeing more public fights break out everywhere, not with you, but with others. Maybe you could just tell us about how you balance distribution and launching new services like ESPN Plus and pricing, given all the pressure we hear about the bundle in the marketplace.
I don't want to characterize the specifics of the negotiations because I don't know that that would necessarily be helpful
right.
to either side. We talked in this conversation already, this is a changing world.
Yeah.
And both sides recognize that. Their ecosystem, the multi-channel ecosystem, while it has been disrupted by the Netflix of this world and by all sorts of other new technologies in the media space, but those platforms are still the most popular, and they still deliver a lot of value to us and to the owners of those platforms. And so I think we recognize when you sit down at the table with any of these entities that there's change in the world, in the marketplace, but there's still value to the business
sure.
at hand. And I think that's essentially what guides these negotiations. I don't, to get into who's got more leverage these days doesn't necessarily help our cause at all. We go to these negotiations, obviously, with a good hand when you have ABC and ESPN and Disney, as a for instance, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's an easy negotiation. We look for, you know, one, we look for, you know, continued price growth, but we also recognize that there's a lot more competition today. Not everyone necessarily wants the multi-channel service the way they once did. So I think we try to be fair. We try to do what's best for our business, and we try to do, you know, what we can to keep their business healthier as well, while we all watch these forces come into the marketplace that I think have happened faster and have had more of a profound impact on how this product is consumed than we ever expected.
How do things like ESPN Plus or the Disney OTT service, is there a way for those to help in the negotiation? Or those can be win-wins with these other partners?
I don't want to speak for the partners. I think they probably prefer that we weren't in those businesses because they view them as competitive, but they're also just at the front of the line to see whether they could distribute the apps. And, in fact, a number of them have already contacted us saying they want to distribute the Disney app.
I think so.
So I think they view it as something that is probably inevitable, at least for our company, because with ESPN and Disney, we've got the brands that enable us to take the product direct to consumer, which is not the case with all of our more traditional competitors. It actually sets us apart from those competitors. I think the distributors understand that, and they want to make sure that when we migrate or as we migrate to a more direct-to-consumer business, that they play a part in how we do that, even if it means slightly lower margins for them or economics that aren't necessarily as attractive as the current economics, but it is a reality.
Yeah. You talked before about the virtual MVPDs, and I feel like we need to get a better name than that, but for better or worse, that's what we're calling these.
New entrants
in the bundled linear network world, the YouTube TVs, the Hulus, the Slings. I mean, the numbers are starting to get reasonably large, at least when we roll them up, north of 4 million. When you look out over the longer term, based on what you're seeing so far, are you encouraged that this may stabilize the universe for the ESPNs and the Disney Channels of the world? Do you see this helping offset some of the skinny bundle pressure you guys have felt?
Well, I think what we're seeing short term, as I said earlier and you just mentioned it, is we're seeing nice growth in these platforms, and I think it speaks volumes for where the consumer is today, and that the consumer does not, more consumers would rather buy a set of channels that is, represents a smaller set of program, of product, for less money. So whether it's a $50 or $40 or 40 channel, 50 channel, that is, I think, looked at as quite attractive today by many consumers. In addition, a lot of these new entrants are not hampered by legacy technology. And so what they can offer their users is a more mobile-first experience and a better user experience in many cases, not in all cases. What we've seen is as these have continued to grow and grow nicely, they have helped mitigate the losses on the expanded basic side of the business. They have not completely erased them, but they have significantly mitigated them. We're still seeing some declines in the multi-channel ecosystem, even with the dramatic growth of these new entrants.
Right.
Whether they get the growth gets to the point where it completely mitigates the losses, I don't know. I think that we're not going to make any predictions, but the signs are quite encouraging that the product that they are offering is attractive to the consumer. And since we've negotiated deals, particularly for ESPN, where ESPN is part of all the bundles that are being offered, that's quite encouraging for us because ESPN did get hurt by a growth in essentially light, cable light bundles that sports or ESPN were not part of. And this obviously helps that a lot. And we have seen a lot of mitigation in that regard, in terms of slowdown in the growth, slowdown in adoption of the light bundles without sports.
Right. Yeah, I think Sling on the Dish call mentioned college football playoffs in particular as helping the Sling business.
But by the way, if you play this out, if the entire, and I'm not predicting that this will happen, but let's just say that the majority of U.S. households end up with a bundle that is 30 to 50 channels, $30, $50 a month. We actually think that's a very good thing for the businesses that we have, because we also believe that the consumer isn't necessarily going to take the $50 to $75 a month savings of not having to buy the expanded basic service. They won't take it out and just put it in the bank. We think they'll actually spend it on more entertainment. And that's where a pure Disney app or an ESPN augmented app or a Hulu app, I think, could benefit greatly.
Yeah, absolutely. Sticking with sports, and you and I have had this conversation before, but what's your perspective on what's happened with the NFL around viewership? And did it influence the company's decision? I believe it was going to the press not to bid on the Thursday night package.
Well, first of all, there's so much more competition in the marketplace for people's time. I've got two teenage boys at home, 19 and 15. They're big sports fans, but the amount of things that they have to watch and the places that they can watch them far different than existed just a few years ago. So just more competition. With more competition means it's a less forgiving marketplace. So if you have a one-game a window package, as we do on Monday night or as Thursday night is, it puts a lot more pressure on that game to be good, on the matchup to be right, on the fact that maybe the quarterback's got to be healthy. As a Green Bay Packer fan, when Aaron Rodgers goes down, the Packers are much less interesting,
right, as a for instance. Right.
It just puts more pressure on things. The NFL still had, 37 of the top 50 programs in the United States, so it still stands very tall. But there's more competition. I don't think we should expect that the highest-rated programs of yesterday will maintain those ratings today or into the future. There are other factors as well, but another one I think on Sundays is, for instance, another contributing factor is the red zone. My teenage boys want to watch the red zone. I don't see commercials in the red zone. I don't even know how that gets rated. I never even thought about that because we're not on Sunday, but I guess if there are no spots, there's no rating. But that's a very popular product.
Sure.
It has to have contributed to some extent to some ratings issues there, but it's a different time. It's still, I think, a very attractive product, though, being on the television side, and the NFL is still quite attractive. Thursday night, we looked at that briefly. The one game a night package was not that attractive to us, meaning having two nights of one game a window for the reasons that I just cited. We also looked at other factors, advertising and retransmission incent and basically sub fees, and just concluded that our hand was fine where it was.
Yeah. How are you thinking, if at all, at this point about the Monday Night Football renewal? It's not that far away. Do you view this as kind of absolutely critical to the ESPN franchise? Or could you see a scenario where you're not carrying those games?
We have a few more years before we have to negotiate. At the moment, we're focused on the Fox acquisition and integration. That'll come next. We've obviously talked about it, but nothing to report on publicly. Certainly, we probably won't be reporting on it publicly for quite a while.
Okay, thought I'd give it a shot. Let's turn to the theme parks business, which is a business that's been executing really well and growing nicely, so obviously gets less attention from the market.
It shouldn't. You get a lot more. You get more attention than ESPN subs.
Right, it's a bigger business than ESPN by a lot at this point, at least our estimates. I wanted to ask you about pricing. Margins have been really strong there. Disney introduced dynamic pricing on single-day tickets a couple years ago. Can you give us an update on how that has influenced attendance and per-cap spending and any lessons you've learned? And are you able to take that to beyond single-day to continue to drive the business economics forward?
Sure. Well, first of all, since we've been talking about the acquisition and the creation of high-quality branded intellectual property. We talk about it typically as it relates to movies and as it relates to television. We don't talk about it as it relates to the theme parks, but over the last decade with Pixar, Marvel, and Lucas, and other investments that we've made in content, we've managed to design and build attractions and walk-around characters and themed hotels and you name it at our parks across the world that have made that product more attractive product. So one of the contributing factors to the health of that business has been the investment we've made in IP. By the way, just as an example, Bob Chapek, who runs Parks and Resorts for us, is here today. He was telling me on the plane flying up here this morning that the line to meet the Black Panther character at Disneyland is an hour long.
No ride.
We haven't had a chance to build a ride. I'm sure there are people who are working on it.
Right.
So we have improved the demand of our parks in part because of the popularity of the intellectual property that we put into the parks around the world. Cars Land in California was certainly a great example of that. In addition to that, we're running a business that separate and apart from all the other businesses in the space in terms of the quality of the experience and the attractiveness of it for adults and kids and people of all generations alike. And with all of that, it's given us the ability to continue to take pricing up over the years. Not only are we infusing with intellectual property that people know, but we're also just spending more in investing.
Yeah.
We're expanding the size, the footprint of the experience that you ultimately have. Technology has given us the ability to add a substantial amount of more flexible or variable pricing across the board. We just announced it in Shanghai. We've been doing it in California. We've been doing it in Florida. In Florida, by the way, very few people buy the one-day pass. We have talked about putting into place flex pricing on the multi-day pass, and that's coming sometime toward the end of the year. All of this has enabled us to do a few things. First of all, we've increased our yield per visit. So when we talked about our earnings the first quarter, we talked about increase in visitation to our parks. We also talked about an increase in yield per guest or per visit.
Yep.
That's basically ticket pricing, food and beverage merchandise, and hotels, all due to variable pricing. The other thing that variable pricing has enabled us is, in peak periods of time is when the most people come. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to smooth out the experience for everyone by basically increasing the pricing during the peak periods and decreasing or not increasing the pricing, I should say, as much in the off periods, so that the experience that you have when you come to our park is just as good in the peak times.
Sure.
As it might be in the times when the park is less crowded. But by and large, this has been an initiative or strategy of Parks and Resorts that is really starting to work, both from a bottom-line perspective, but also from a guest experience perspective, and you will see more of that in the years ahead.
Great. When you think about bringing new IP into the parks, and I'm thinking particularly about Toy Story Land later this year and then Star Wars Land, and I believe in 19, can you just help put in context sort of how big those attractions are in the context of the business? Are they a material increase in size and scope?
We're building two Star Wars Lands, one in Orlando and one in California, to open in calendar 2019. We've not given specific dates. They're the largest lands we've ever built. So they're not separate gates, but they're separate lands, and they are big. And they are big both in terms of footprint, but also they'll be big in terms of experience. Very, very high-end e-ticket attractions using not only great IP, but technology, and fully immersing guests in the galaxy far, far away. I'm pretty excited about them. Toy Story Land is opening up in Florida this spring and opening up in Shanghai also sometime this spring. They're big as well, and we'll take advantage of the popularity of that IP. And I mentioned earlier we have a fourth Toy Story movie coming in 2019. And we're also adding more Marvel in the park in California. We're adding more Marvel in the park in Hong Kong, and we're talking about adding more Marvel in other parks and other locations around the world as well. And so there's a lot of investment in parks and resorts. I can go on. We've made certain. There's so much going on that I lose track of what we've announced. Well, we haven't announced, but there's a lot. We're also building three new cruise ships and, and themed hotels, which is also quite interesting because, in general, over time, we've built hotels that are somewhat generic in nature. They're good hotels, but we have not used the intellectual property as much in the hotels to essentially differentiate the experience from other hotels either that we've built or hotels that are off property. And we're starting to do more of that. It's something that Bob has initiated as head of the unit. And one of them that we're designing and building in is in Florida, and it's Star Wars themed hotel experience.
Wow.
It should be quite different.
Cool. You've only got to
announce that already, right? Good.
For the webcast, they're nodding.
We haven't announced it. We just did.
Right, we just did. With the few minutes we have left up, I wanted to make sure we touched on the small business that you have in the studio and consumer products. We led with Black Panther, but one of the things I was wondering about is, you know, Disney, more than any other company, has to manage and grow franchises. And, you know, obviously we talked about Star Wars, got the new Frozen coming out. At the same time, we see major changes in how consumers interact with brands and with franchises, and their spending patterns are changing, and e-commerce is changing, how people interact with product. And you've been in this business for a long time. Do you look at managing franchises at Disney as fundamentally different today than, say, 10 years ago? Is it harder, particularly for millennials and the younger generation, to keep their attention on these big properties, or is it maybe easier if they stand out in the clutter more?
I think they stand out in the clutter more. I think what's hardest is we've been creating so many new big franchises that we're competing with ourselves in some ways. And we've got a new one now, a big one now. By the way, when we talk about a franchise, we talk about a franchise that is usually it's a character or a set of characters that we say leverageable across our businesses.
Right.
So it typically works as a movie or a TV show, and in our parks and resorts and as consumer products line. And we also talk about being able to leverage a franchise across territories in the world. So typically they're global in nature. And the last thing we look at is essentially longevity, something that will last a long time. That's a franchise for us. We have been talking about having $11 billion franchises. Those are franchises that generate essentially $1 billion in global sales, or retail sales, annually. And that's a lot. That's more than any other company has. And they all compete for shelf space these days, whether it's shelf space online, shelf space, or, you know, there's shelf space online, even though it seems infinite, or shelf space at big box retailers. It's not necessarily a bad problem to have. In terms of people's interest in basically character merchandise, that sometimes rises and falls with the times, but I think we've got something, a great example now with Black Panther. I pretty much guarantee you that this coming Halloween and even Christmas, you're going to be seeing a lot of Black Panther merchandise in the marketplace. You will today already, and because of the popularity of the character and the storytelling and the fact that people, not just kids, but adults too, you know, want to have some part of that. I don't know. I can't really say that we detect a pattern other than the pattern that is our own, which is a pattern of great success.
Yeah.
And we're going to continue to look to create franchises, although I think there's another thing that's somewhat misunderstood. When we go out to set out to make a movie, people think we try to check every box. Is this a franchise? Check this and that and that. You can't do that. You have to just try to make a great movie.
Yeah.
And if in making a great movie it becomes a franchise, that's fantastic. We try to recognize that possibility before the movie comes out so that we basically, you know, prepare the platforms for it. So in Black Panther's case, we set out to make a great movie. As we saw early cuts of the film, we had an even better sense that we had something special, and we immediately engaged more aggressively with retailers around the world to step up their program. I actually was in Bentonville this October talking about Black Panther. And now we think we've got a great franchise, but not every great movie we make becomes a franchise. Coco's another example of a great movie. Not sure that's necessarily a franchise, but we're very proud of the fact that we made it and it did extremely well at the box office. It's nominated for an Academy Award, and that's not a bad thing.
Not at all. Well, Bob, thank you so much for your time, and I hope you'll come back again next year and share your
views. Thank you.
Thank you.